Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming, and welcome to Season 9. Yes, this is Season 9 of the podcast, and we have a great show. The overall arcing theme of this show is activism, and I hope that through these particular guests that I have, through their activism, I hope it inspires you to be active, especially as 2024 progresses. All right, so without any further ado, let's start this episode off with a moment of news. The Kansas City Chiefs won their third Super Bowl in 5 years, defeating the San Francisco 49ers 25-22 in overtime. During their victory celebration days later, near Kansas City Union Station, one person was killed and 21 persons were injured in a mass shooting incident. Three men were immediately placed in custody. The Republican-controlled House, in their second attempt, impeached Homeland Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over immigration enforcement and alleged false statements to Congress. Democrat Tom Zuzi won a special congressional election in New York, filling the seat previously held by expelled Republican George Santos. This win narrows the Republican majority in the House. Donald Trump appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to recognize his immunity from prosecution regarding his actions to overturn the 2020 election results. Five U.S. Marines en route to the Marine Corps Air Station in Miramar, California, died in a helicopter crash near San Diego during a training flight in a winter storm. Two off-duty law enforcement officers killed a woman who opened fire at Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. The shooter was accompanied by a child who was among two injured during the incident. A 15-month investigation into President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents ended with no charges. Donald Trump won Republican presidential nominating caucuses in Nevada and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was admitted to a critical care unit for an emergent bladder issue and temporarily transferred his duties to Deputy Secretary Kathleen Hicks. Austin was released days later and was working from his home. The Biden administration is awaiting the results of an internal UN investigation before resuming aid to UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. A Florida resident pled guilty in a U.S. court case linked to the 2021 assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Serious threats to U.S. federal judges and prosecutors have more than doubled over 3 years, driven by political violence, according to U.S. Marshals Service data. U.S. farm consolidation continues, with the number of farms dropping by 7% since 2017 and the average farm size increasing. And travel on U.S. roads in 2023 increased by 2.1%, reaching a new record of 3.263 trillion miles, surpassing pre-COVID-19 levels. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been A Moment of News. All right, so you noticed that that moment of news was not done by Grace G, it was done by me. Grace has informed me that she has got a health issue that she is dealing with, so I asked all y'all that are listening to pray for her. I think she's going to be okay, but praying for her recovery is important. And hopefully, you know, after a few weeks, she'll be back in the groove again. So I want to take this opportunity to thank her for what she's done so far. And hopefully that, you know, when she gets back, we can get right into the swing of things. So again, y'all keep Grace G in your thoughts and prayers. All right, now it's time for my first guest. And her name is Della Duncan. Della Z. Duncan is a renegade economist. Areas of her livelihood garden include supporting individuals as a right livelihood coach, helping transition businesses and organizations as a post-capitalist consultant, teaching and facilitating courses and retreats on the work that reconnects and regenerative economics, and hosting the Upstream podcast, which challenges mainstream economic thinking through documentaries, and conversations, including the green transition, the problem with green capitalism, and the myth of freedom under capitalism. Della is also the course development manager of the Fritjof Capra course on the systems view of life, a founding member of the California Donut Economics Coalition, a senior fellow of social and economic equity at the London School of Economics, a Gross National Happiness Master Trainer, and a senior lecturer of renegade economics and regenerative livelihoods at the California Institute of Integral Studies, Santa Cruz Permaculture, Vita Cycles Permaculture, and Gaia Education. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Della Duncan. All right, Della Duncan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm honored to have you on. When I was reading about you a little bit, I said, oh, this would be good, because I've had a quote unquote traditional economist on the show. And, you know, so when I ran across your profile and started reading about some of the stuff you were talking about and promoting, I said, this will be a good conversation for my audience to kind of continue to open their minds about certain things. But before we get into the interview part, one of the things I like to do is to give the person a quote, the guest a quote. And it's either something that they might have said, something that's related to the work they're doing or whatever. So your quote is, "In America, we debate everything except capitalism. If there's an institution in your society that's above criticism, you're giving it a free pass to indulge all of its weaknesses and darker tendencies." So what does that quote mean to you?
So when I hear that quote, I think about Margaret Thatcher, who said, "Tina, there is no alternative." And she was referring to neoliberal capitalism. And she was really speaking to this trend since the 80s of people believing that capitalism is the only system, it is the best system, and there is no alternative. And so it is above criticism. And so, as a renegade economist and as someone who really cares about equality and democracy and living in better harmony with this planet, I believe we have to interrogate and challenge and critique capitalism as well as mainstream economics to view what are the underlying assumptions and then to discover, uncover, and uplift the alternatives that are out there that would bring us much greater health and prosperity in the more holistic sense and a better connection with the living planet.
So, what is a renegade economist?
So I call myself a renegade economist, and I want to honor that I got that term from a fellow renegade economist, Kate Raworth. She was called that. And so I said, oh, I aspire as well to be a renegade economist. So to be a renegade economist is to look at the history of economics and the teaching of mainstream economics and the way that it is portrayed in societies, and to challenge it and to interrogate it and to ask what are the assumptions underlying economics, and to also find those alternatives that would bring us better health and regenerative ways of living on this planet and also greater solidarity and equality. So just to give some examples, if you were to go in a mainstream economics classroom or to speak with a mainstream economist, there are some assumptions that would be underlying their thinking that they wouldn't challenge, such as work is a disutility, meaning we as humans don't like to work, such as nature can be commodified. It can be put a price upon. It can be commodified or financialized. Another is that capitalism is the best system and the only system. Another assumption is that growth is good, growth of individual wealth, growth of GDP, gross domestic product, and growth of profit for a business. That not only is that good, but that ought to be the goal, what is focused on, and also that endless growth or limitless growth is possible on our planet. And so those are just a few. I could go on, but there's these assumptions underlying mainstream economic thinking that hopefully folks listening can see how they would then lead to homelessness, suicide, inequality, environmental degradation, etc.
So, how did you make the transition from being a rape crisis counselor to being a practitioner of sustainable economics?
So my first job after college was as a rape crisis counselor, and I had been inspired in college by teaching the Vagina Monologues, by directing it, and I was really touched by how many folks really had experienced sexual violence. So I felt called to that work, and I was doing that. And while I was there, I heard the upstream metaphor, which I believe comes from public health, and the metaphor to go upstream is to take a societal problem and to go upstream to the root causes. So we were told this metaphor to show why it's not just important to support survivors of sexual violence, but to go upstream to the root causes, to intervene there and to do some prevention work. So I heard this metaphor and I thought, well, this work is very impactful and powerful. And yet what really broke my heart was the context around the work. The fact that the work that we were doing as rape crisis counselors seemed to have little value in the economy that we were embedded in. Now, just to note, I'm in San Francisco, so this was in Silicon Valley, right? So I was just noticing really large pay differentials within places, but also between industries. And I was also feeling that our work wasn't valued in terms of we had to compete for dwindling state funding. And even the fact that our work was mandated by the state, it wasn't valued by the state economy. So from that moment, I went on a journey upstream to figure out what are the root causes of the economic and political and social ecological challenges of our time? And how do our assumptions and our ways of teaching around mainstream economics contribute to them?
And just for the record, you're like the second guest I've had whose beginnings in what we would call political or community activism came from the Vagina Monologues. I just wanted to point that out.
Oh, that's awesome. Great.
Yeah. And it seems to be turning out some really positive people. So let me ask you this question. Do you believe capitalism and white supremacy are interconnected? And if you do, why? And if you don't, why not?
Yes, I do. So I've heard that people say that another word for capitalism is racial capitalism. And what they're doing there, even though it feels redundant, maybe, is really emphasizing that capitalism is linked to white supremacy and that capitalism is racialized. Now, one way to understand this connection is to go back to the inception of capitalism. So moving from feudalism to capitalism, one of the things that needed to happen was a process that Karl Marx calls primitive accumulation. So there needed to be the separation between the workers and the owners, right? The capitalist and the workers. And in order to do that, there needed to be accumulation of wealth, right? For those capitalists to then own the means of production. So the way that they did this, this processes of primitive accumulation, included slavery, land theft of indigenous peoples, colonization, and destruction of the environment. And for those processes to happen, there needed to be a dehumanization of people of color and people of the global South. And so that is one clear way that capitalism needed and came about in direct connection with white supremacy. And then not just historical, to this day, capitalism is upheld with this separation of those who have and those who have not. Those who have and don't have to work a lot for it because their money makes work or because they own the means of production, and those who have to sell their labor. And again, in order to have that division, we need to have white supremacy. So capitalism and white supremacy are so interconnected throughout history and up to this present day.
Yeah, and I saw on, I think it was your TikTok or it was something that a social media platform you had, you actually like had a flow chart and somebody else created it, but you posted it. And it basically, the bottom line was the flow chart connected supremacy and capitalism. It was almost like simultaneous, and no matter what direction the flow chart went, it all came back to capitalism and supremacy, which I thought was a real simple way of breaking it down, just like you just did in that answer. Explain the concept of donut economics.
I would love to, especially knowing about your political career. So donut economics actually comes from that person, Kate Raworth, who I said I got the phrase renegade economist from. So this realm of donut economics is in that realm of questioning growth, the growth imperative. So again, capitalism is addicted to growth, and mainstream economics and capitalism believe growth is good and infinite growth is possible on our planet. So there's a whole movement of folks, and donut economics is a part of it, called post-growth, which are folks saying, hey, wait a sec, look at what's happening to our planet. Our ecological boundaries, our ecosystems are in stress. We are in overshoot. Particularly a small group of people, but we as humans are really impacting our planet negatively. And so donut economics says, let us change the goal of the economy. Let us change it from growth, so growth of gross domestic product, growth of business, right, profit, or growth of wealth. Let us change that goal to something that we can all get behind, well-being. And not just well-being for humans, but well-being for people and the planet. And one reason why donut economics is so successful is because it has an image attached to it. So I want you to imagine in your mind's eye the hole of a donut, so a donut hole. And in that hole, I want you to imagine the human needs, okay? And you can see them as like a pie. And these needs include water, healthcare, food, housing, political voice, and several others. And imagine wherever you are, whatever city or bioregion, state, country, imagine that you shade those in. How is your community doing at meeting those human needs? Okay, that's part one. But then the outer part of the donut is what are the needs of your ecosystems? So wherever you are, the ecosystems that your economy and that your society is embedded in, how are they doing? How is the biodiversity loss? How is the ocean acidification? How is the change in land use? How is carbon emissions? These are called the planetary tipping points. And so the idea of the donut is how can we get our economy to meet all of the human needs within our economy, but stay within the ecological needs. So, meeting our human needs within consideration of our ecological needs. And so, that donut part is called the safe and just space for humanity. You can imagine it with sprinkles. And the idea is let us change the goal of our economies from growth to getting us within the donut. So, I just want to say that's the model. And right now, there's places and people all over the world who are measuring the donut for their communities, and then who are really creating a movement and collaboration around how do we then get ourselves within the donut wherever we are.
Now, when I was listening to you just then and reading some of your earlier interviews, there was a word that came to mind, and you can tell me if it's fair or not fair. And that word is eugenics, right? Because there was a movement in the early part of the 20th century to really push for controlling population growth in order to have a more sustainable society and planet as a whole. Am I true in my assessment that what you're saying is not an advocation for eugenics, it's an advocation for better stewardship?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely not a call for eugenics at all. And also, very much, yeah, how do we steward the planet and how do we share resources? So, it is more about equity and inclusivity and also enoughness, right? There's this like, what is enough for each of us and for our economies? So, all of that is a part of it. And just to say, I totally hear you that this population question can come up in this conversation around sustainable economics and post-growth economics. And my favorite understanding of this is the IPAT equation. So it's I equals P times A times T. I is human impact on the planet equals P population times A affluence and times T. Okay, so our population size, our affluence, which is like how much wealth and how much stuff and how much, like we can say greed we are exhibiting, and then technology, right? And of course, population, that is the least, well, politically feasible, but also morally apprehensible, like thing to look at. But if we look at affluence, so are we all living with one planetary, one planet living, right? Or are we living beyond our, like what we could each live, right? Are we stewarding what we have control over? Are we having too much, right? And then technology can be a positive in the equation, meaning a detriment to our human impact on the planet, but it also can be a decimal. Technology can help us live more regeneratively and sustainably on this planet. So I totally hear you. And yes, I do try to say that is not the focus, the population size, and it is more about distribution and enoughness.
Yeah, 'cause greed is to me the biggest problem, as opposed to how many people are on the planet, or
Absolutely.
just urban sprawl as opposed to whatever. It's greed, and I guess you can say sprawl is part of that too. But I hear people and economists always talk about, if there was this government policy, and if we raise wages for people and all this stuff factors into inflation. But to me, the biggest culprit of inflation is greed. It's like, just because you have to pay your workers more money doesn't mean that you have to raise the price of your products. Just because Now I get it. If you are lacking materials to build stuff, it's going to cost you more to build it. That kind of thing, like when wars happen, like what's going on in Ukraine, for example. But, to me, the general evil that's out there that is causing a lot of the problems we're having in a capitalist society and even in communism, right? Because that's what we looked at the Soviet Union as supposed to be the model of communism, but it was about greed. And in that case, it was about accumulation of power as opposed to accumulation of wealth, right? So but that's just me. Am I off base in how I think about that?
No, relatedly, there's one of the most inspiring or hopeful graphs in economics that I know of is the Kahneman curve, which has on one side happiness and on the other side income, right? One axis happiness, one axis income. And what it shows is that for folks who don't have a lot of money, more money does equal more happiness. Okay, so you can see that line kind of going up that more money equals more happiness. But what they found in this curve was that it plateaus, meaning at a certain point, more money does not equal more happiness. And that to me is one of the most hopeful things that I've seen, because what it tells me is that yes, there are a lot of people who do not have enough, who are living paycheck to paycheck or very precariously, or even with a lot of debt. Right. And for those people, we do need to support them with services, but also with higher wages. And we know that there is a plateau. We know that there is a point where more money doesn't equal more happiness. There is a point of enoughness. So just it illustrates your point beautifully about really greed, taking more than our fair share, taking more than we need, taxing our environment, exploiting others to get that material wealth. That is the challenge.
So I guess this ties into this question, which is asking you to explain your work as a right livelihood coach. Because if I understand the concept is that if you find a job or a career path that gives you happiness, then hopefully your income will match that, but you're more at peace to dealing with the income you have because you're in the right job for your personality or your objectives toward contributing to society or whatever. And this is me as an outsider trying to understand what you do. So tell me exactly what you do.
Of course. Well, let's follow off of that conversation we just had about enoughness and greed. So, one of the places where I've found a lot of insight and a lot of deep philosophy is Buddhism, right? So, Buddhism really talks about the three poisons are greed, hatred, and delusion, right? If we're to go upstream to the root causes, that's what Buddhism would say. And so, coming from Buddhism, there's this concept of right livelihood, which I love because what it says is that Buddhism isn't just about mindfulness, right? That stereotypical sitting on a cushion, mindfully meditating. It's not about that. It's about ethical living. And so, right livelihood is how do we take a mindfulness practice and a spiritual practice, if you want to call it that? How do we take that off the cushion and into our daily lives? So, right livelihood is about ethical living and ethical working, right? And there's so many elements of this. There is what do you do? So, what we do can contribute to human health and vitality, like your podcast, right? Or someone who's working serving food or growing food, et cetera, or teaching, right? So, supporting human or ecological health and happiness and vitality. Or our work can contribute to suffering, right? Suffering and harm to people and the planet. And then there's the form or the structure of our work, that sometimes the form and structure of our work can be non-democratic, can be not transparent, can be harmful or exploitative, right? Or it could be cooperative and collaborative and regenerative in the structure or the form of our work. And then there's also our attitude towards our work. So some folks may know there may be times when you have a job that on paper looks like a great job, but you just really don't like it, right? That's about our attitude towards our work. There's also the culture of our work. It can be a purpose-driven, excellent, mission-driven, beautiful organization and still have a really toxic culture. So that's another element of right livelihood. So right livelihood is how are we aligning our values with our work in the world? And I came to be a right livelihood coach because I was hosting the podcast, which I really started as this upstream journey to get to know what is it about our economic system? What are the assumptions and why is it not providing us with health and happiness? And then from that, as I was learning, folks were reaching out and saying, how could I make sense of this in my own life? Like, okay, this is great in theory, but what does this mean for me? So, right livelihood coaching is a way to bring that into people's everyday lives. And right now, there's such an interesting time of people who are quitting jobs, right? We heard of quiet quitting, right? This idea that people are saying, hey, things are happening, whether it's politically, ecologically, socially, and I want to contribute. Like, I want to make a difference. And so, how could I better align what I care about and the work I want to do in the world with my work? And just to say, though, right livelihood can also feel like a privilege because it can, for some people listening, they may think that's great, but it's so hard to even get a job, let alone one that is meaningful or contributing or one that I feel really good about. And so it's also important for us to change our economic systems so that more people can have right livelihood. So, what are the ways that we support people's access to services and taking care of themselves, meeting their own and community needs? And then also, how can we create more jobs that are more regenerative and democratic and transparent and just?
So, if I ask you a question I asked another guest, what policy would you like to see enacted in order to achieve a supremacy, coercion, discrimination, and exploitation-free capitalistic economy? You would say what?
I would say that I wouldn't create a capitalist economy at all. So I wouldn't, I don't think there is, I think ethical capitalism, green capitalism is an oxymoron or like a tension that it doesn't exist. So I would actually change the economy. So how would I create or what policy would I offer to create an economy that is more truly regenerative and just and democratic and equitable and not exploitative and harmful, like you were saying. One policy would be that each city or county, state, country adopt the donut as its measurement tool. So first to do that assessment, right? How is your economy doing at meeting the human needs in your economy and staying within the needs of the ecology that your economy is embedded in? Just do that assessment and just see. And what a lot of places are going to find, and really Kate Raworth says, there is no developed country because she says there's no country that has met all the human needs and is staying within their planetary boundaries. So we all have work to do on this. But I think it'll be shocking for folks to see, wow, our economy is really not serving our needs. It's not helping us meet our needs or allocate resources equitably and fairly and regeneratively. And we're also going way over what our planet can handle, can sustain. So first being aware of that, and then bring in the solidarity economy, cooperative economy, new economy, next system, feminist economy, all those bring in their practices, their principles, their theories, their models to get us within the donut wherever you are in the world, wherever that policy is enacted.
If people want to get in touch with you, if people want to reach out to you and find out more about donut economics, what if people want to be like you and become a renegade economist, how can they do that?
So my website is delazeduncan.com, and the donut economics book that I would recommend is Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist by Kate Raworth. But there's also the Donut Economics Action Lab, which is a place where people can come together and meet others in their community and start working on the donut. Personally, I helped start the California Donut Economics Coalition. So if anyone's in California, connect with us. It's caldec.org, caldec.org. But I'm also on LinkedIn and all the social media. So Delazy Duncan, you can find me there. And then I do have the podcast that I co-host, which is the Upstream Podcast. So those are some ways that you can get in touch with me, and I'd love to hear from folks.
All right. Well, Della Duncan, I greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast. I hope that my listeners' minds have been opened a little bit about some things. And I appreciate the work that you're doing as far as, bringing forth alternate thought toward how we do things in our economy and in our lives. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for hosting this conversation and for inviting me.
All right, guys, and we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. And so now is time for my next guest, Ms. Marcy Bianco. Marcy Bianco is a writer, editor, and cultural critic. Her first book, Breaking Free, The Lie of Equality and the Feminist Fight for Freedom, was published in September 2023 by Public Affairs. And this is the book we're going to be talking about. So ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have, as a guest on this podcast, Ms. Marcy Bianco. All right, Marcy Bianco, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm good. Really happy to have you on the show. I really like this book, Breaking Free. I really like this book.
Thank you.
Did I say it right? Is it Breaking Free or Break Free?
No, it's Breaking Free. I mean, we got to, you know, we break free, breaking free. There was a gerund in there to make it active. As active as possible. No, I really appreciate it. It's a heady book at times to read. Ideas books are heady and they're toothsome. So I really appreciate you saying that and taking the time, you know, giving time, valuable time in your life to read the book.
Yeah, well, it's heady as you put it, but it's an easy read.
Thank you.
You know, and so and most of the books that I've been able to, you know, talk to the authors about have fallen into that category, and I think we're in a really great point as far as nonfiction literature goes, and an interesting time since we've got people wanting to ban books. But that's a conversation for another day. Normally, how I try to start off the interviews is I pull a quote, right? Yeah. And it's either from something that the guest has written, an interview they may have done, or something that's related to the subject matter we're going to talk about. So your quote is, "Equity is a lie. It is a myth perpetuated to coax women into complicity with their oppression. Women are not equal to men. No two people are equal. We are not born equal or with equal advantages. We do not experience life equally." What does that quote mean to you?
Yeah. So first, that's the beginning of the book. Equality is a lie. There's a little differentiation I know in the book between equality and equity, right? Like we know that, but both work to the same, to reinforce the same structure, the same system that, you know, to quote Ijeoma Alu, is not broken, but is working according to its design. So I wanted to come out firing in this book. Like this is the introduction. And I think what motivated the book were a set of questions and a set of lived experiences, both my personal experiences, but witnessing the world, right? Like witnessing how people treat each other, how laws are written, and yet how they are practiced or implemented, how different that is. And, you know, I've been really curious in terms of feminism and in terms of women's rights, why we've been so wedded to equality. And I thought it was really important up front to state flatly, like, we are not equal. No one is equal to each other. And I feel like that's a fact. And I wanted to state it as strongly and as factually as possible, because to say otherwise is really, I feel, dehumanizing and disrespectful to the particular situations or context of people's lives. Like, just in this country alone, we know that, the healthcare system, the labor force, like how we treat each other and the societal discrimination, whether it's racism or misogyny, right? We each come into the world differently, even within our own families. Like, if you're the eldest born, if you're like, there are no two people who go through this life similarly. And that last line really said it all. We live differently, our freedoms and our lives are situated, and we have to move forward in this world understanding that we are not equal. And what does that mean? Because I feel like there's a real anxiety, a social anxiety around acknowledging that we are not equal, that we are not born on equal footing, that we are not treated equally, and that we do not, have the same advantages, in this life. And that's, I think, a racist anxiety, right? I think there's like a lot of white anxiety. There's a lot of misogynistic anxiety around acknowledging those differences. And I think that comes across in things like, the notion of color blindness, which we know that several Supreme Court justices invoked when they overturned affirmative action, right? So this past year, I mean, they are invoking this myth of color blindness, that we're all created equal under God's eyes, right? To kind of push forward, discrimination, and to overturn actual policies that help get people the kind of education that is critical to their own life and their own life's advancement.
So you kind of answered the next question about what was your motivation, which is good. You know, that's helpful, because like I said, I've got a lot of questions based off of this book. It really provoked me. So I'll move on to the next question. You identify yourself as a capital A, capital F, angry feminist. Explain what that means.
Well, I say that up front because it's almost a way, with this introduction being very manifesto-like, I wanted to impart that vigor and that tone, because in a way it's challenging readers who, or potential readers who might just toss the book aside and say, well, I'm not reading this garbage because she's an angry feminist. And I actually wanted to claim that identity head on and say, I'm this type of person. The irony being, as I explain in that section, that I refuse to identify as a feminist for like the first 25 years of my life. I was like, I don't think so. Like, I am not one of these people. Like, I don't identify with this agenda, because I grew up in Southern New Jersey in a very, like, in the Reagan era, in the Reagan, like, Reagan country. My town, like, had butter trucks with Confederate flags, and to, like, there was a very, as well, like, there was a very strong anti-feminist backlash at the time. So I was being socialized and like, I won't say indoctrinated, but socially conditioned to have a certain view about what feminism was. And so I say angry feminism up front as a kind of reclaiming of the term, but also to be very forthright about my own position moving forward in the book, and how interrogative the book is, and how unapologetic the book is. And in some ways too, when I think about it, one of the things I was trying to do, several things in this book, but I didn't want this book to be based in certain emotions or forces that I feel are stereotyped as feminists, whether that's shame or victimhood. I wanted this to be, a book that you read and you felt powerful, that you felt potential, that was hopeful, even though there's so much going on in the world that really, throws that into doubt sometimes. But, the books that really had an impact on my life, like when I would read them, I could feel them in my skin. I could feel them in my blood. And that's kind of what I, in a way, wanted to accomplish. Like, again, a lot of objectives, but I wanted people to read this and be like, hell yeah, like, this is what we need to do.
Well, that feeling in your blood thing, you kind of did that for me. If
Oh,
nobody
cool.
else, at least you know one person felt it in their blood.
Thank you.
How has white supremacist, cis, heteropatriarchy shaped the idea of equality? I hope I said all that right. That's a lot.
Oh, that's good. That no, that look, I even say that is a mouthful, even for me with my big mouth. But that, first and foremost, that is invoking the work of bell hooks, who figured so strongly in the for me as an influence in the writing of this book, more so than I had actually imagined. Like, you have your inspirations, you have your sources, and I look like such a seminal figure of feminism as we know it today, but her work just really played such a important part in my own thinking, and I am indebted to her and countless other Black feminists. But she is the one that has this idea of this, people would say intersectionality. I know that's kind of like, it's trendy, and then it's not trendy to talk about intersectionality, or it's just this idea of interlocking oppressions. And so that term is coming directly from her, and it shapes equality because equality is something that is an artifice. It is an application. It's not organic, right? Like, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning saying, "You know what? I feel equal today."
Right.
Like, there's not a feeling. Like, I don't know anyone who thinks that. I don't know anyone who goes throughout the world thinking that, like, I am living. It's something that I'm doing. Equality isn't a doing. It's something that's handed to us. And our systems, the systems in America, were founded in the enslavement of Black people, were founded on the genocide of Indigenous people. And these systems, right, they're white supremacist systems, they're heteropatriarchal systems, and they're systems that reinforce a cisgender ideology. They only let certain people advance, they promote certain people, and you have to play the game and act a certain way to be accepted into those systems. And so the thing is, if we're given equality within these systems, it's like I use the metaphor of Play-Doh. If you squeeze an ideal through the Play-Doh mold of, white supremacist cis heteropatriarchy, that equality, right? Whether it's a law, whether it's a policy, is going to come out the other side looking like that. And that is the profound difference. That mold, how it shapes equality, how equality is enacted, it produces the difference in equality in the law, theoretically, and equality as it is experienced, if at all, in the world. And, we see this time and again. We see this with voting rights, right? Like, I talk about the 15th and 19th Amendment, but who has been given the right to vote? Who has been allowed to practice their voting rights? Historically, from the moment the 15th Amendment was signed to give Black men the right to vote, we had state-led and citizen-led efforts to stymie their voting rights, right? To throw out ballots. This is historical. So yeah, I think I rambled way too much there, but I hope I answered your question, Eric.
No, you answered it very well. And the question about we wake up, I don't wake up being equal. I wake up thinking I'm exceptional, right? I think that I'm unique and all that. So that strengthens the point that you're saying. We don't wake up thinking that, oh God, I hope that I'm at the same level as everybody else. we think that we're special. And you know, the trick with a democracy is to get all these special people to follow the playbook. And some people are going to improvise a little bit, but for the most part, you follow the playbook and make sure that everybody is moving in harmony with each other, right? That's why I love football so much, but that's a whole nother conversation.
I mean, but you're right, though. And you know what? What's people have, especially the past 8 years or so, have really been thinking about. I think more and more people are thinking about the state of US democracy. What threatens this democracy? Beyond just the individual level of certain persons, right, who have, who have political power. But I really believe it's several things being, this myth of American individualism, right? You're talking about everybody moving in harmony, this idea of civic mindedness. I feel like individualism, right, that I am out there for myself and that my actions do not impact anyone else. This kind of libertarian mindset that really conflicts with notions of democracy where we are trying to respect the human dignity of each other, trying to live in a society with each other, right? So that's one. I think capitalism is another. I mean, this I, this sense of individualism, which I do talk about in terms of white freedom, right? And I credit Ta-Nehisi Coates and the late historian Tyler Stovall, who was at Princeton University, with really giving us the idea of white freedom, which sits at the center, that really has a stranglehold in the minds of Americans, right? This idea that I am free, therefore I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, and there will be no consequences, right? And we see this mouth by various people. We know the person who used to be our president said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. No one would care, right? This idea of living in a vacuum or a silo, that is not freedom. But yet there's been this conservative stranglehold in our imagining, right? And the idea of what freedom is. And part of what I'm doing in this book is saying, actually, there's a long lineage of Black feminists, of queer feminists, of Black freedom fighters who know, and we know living in this world, right? Like, I am not free until you're free. Our freedoms are interconnected because we live in this world together, right? Like, it's almost, sometimes it's so mind-boggling. It almost feels like a kind of gaslighting to think that, how can you not see that our lives are interconnected, that we need to ensure that people have the care and the support systems and the opportunities, the educational opportunities, right? In order for us all to create a society where we're all thriving. I had to pause when writing this book because I thought, isn't this obvious to folks? Like, maybe I should not be writing this book because you would think that's what it would be.
Well, you know, that reminds me of two sayings. One, the general theme of your answer, which is that somebody once said, and I'm paraphrasing, either we can live together as brothers and sisters or we can perish as fools. But then to answer your last question while you were pausing about the book, common sense ain't common. So, you know, but that leads me to it helps me jump ahead to a question since you brought it up about white freedom. Do you believe we will ever get to a point where to be free is to be white and to be white is to be free is no longer the standard?
That white freedom. Yeah, so that's Tyler Stovall's book called White. That's a quote from his book, White Freedom. I absolutely recommend that book. He rest in peace, was just an amazing thinker. I want to believe, and I have to believe it is possible. And I think it's impossible, or sorry, I think it is possible, given the fact that ideas are viral, right? Like, they are communicable. We can share them, we can learn, if people want to learn, if their minds are open to learning. And I think given precedent, right? Like, I don't believe that the notion of white freedom was always all-consuming and was so ubiquitous that it's something that has been reinforced over and over again to create the social conditioning that led to this belief, that led to this ubiquity. And I work with language and in the realm of ideas, so we see this happen a lot. What people refer to as the culture wars, right? Like how we refer to certain events or certain ideas, that's where a lot of the power and a lot of the challenge lays for me. So I have to believe, you know, like again, what I want to do with this book is start that conversation, or, you know, I think for a lot of folks, help advance that conversation or give language to that conversation. Because again, like I had friends, you know, like you ask friends to read your book in advance, make sure the ideas are there, you know, you pay like folks to like, you know, do some proofreading. And depending on my friend's own experience, their own expertise, like I had several friends of mine, Black scholars, be like, I know this. This book is not for me. And I was, you know, it made me think like, oh, you're right. I know, like, you're absolutely right because you know this. Like, it was a real wake-up moment for me because it made me think like, who is the audience that will be, you know, like that I'm trying to wake up? Because it's clearly not these Black scholars who know this. They're already awakened to all of this, you know? And it was a fair point. I was like, yeah, you're right. Like it was just, even to me, I was like, oh, that's absolutely right. But I really have to believe that it's possible. And I want us to have this collective conversation about what freedom is. Freedom is not, you know, and this is again Stovall, but it's also Simone de Beauvoir, who's a big influence in the book. And she wrote a lot about freedom. And she said, you know, a freedom that is interested in denying the freedom of others is not freedom at all. And so we have the white freedom mindset based on domination. Right? I must be able to dominate you in order to be free. I must be able to intimidate you by walking out in the streets with my gun, you know, in order to be free. That's not freedom. Nobody feels free when they see someone walking down the street with a gun, right? There's the opposite feeling of freedom when you see that. But that kind of mindset, that's white freedom. And we need to challenge that. And in my domain, again, I'm trying to work with language and ideas.
Speaking about language, how is the word fairness a dog whistle?
Oh Lord, here we go. So I talk about fairness in several ways. But it's, you know, it's really interesting because fairness seems to be employed when people want to push back against power changes or power shifts. And we see how fairness has really come into play in two particular ways. I refer to it as like part of the language and logic of equality. So fairness is almost used in tandem with sameness. But, you know, in particular, we see fairness used when people want to and affirmative action, and when people want to prevent trans folks from participating in sports. And I always wonder what sense of fairness, like, what is fairness based on? Right? So, like, these people employ the language of fairness, but it's often employed to exclude other folks. So, I see it as code, as a dog whistle to enact this kind of discrimination. And I talk about it again in those particular contexts of college admissions and also in sports. We know that, well, I say it's a code for discrimination, but it's used as the linchpin to promote these particular types of hatred.
Quickly go over the three steps of reclaiming freedom for feminism.
This is really good. I love it. So in the book, I talk about how we can actually practice freedom. And what was really important to me was, a lot of people, when they talk about feminism, they have a hard time understanding how it applies to their daily lives. Again, because if you think about it in terms of equality, we have to wait for, the white men in power to give it to us. So it's like while people are waiting around twiddling their fingers, thumbs, they're like, well, how does feminism relate to my daily life? And that results in a lot of like superficial type of feminism, like buying a tote bag with fallopian tubes on it, or like all this kind of performative feminism, which I really find problematic. So freedom for me, again, quoting several folks, including Angela Davis, right? It's a constant struggle, meaning it's a daily practice. And I wanted to make it applicable to how we live in our daily lives. So the first step is claim it, right? And this is James Baldwin, right? No one's gonna give you, I mean, several people, but James Baldwin was also a big figure for me in this book. No one's gonna hand you your freedom. It's something that you have to declare, acknowledge and declare, but understand that it's situated. This is Simone de Beauvoir, right? No one is born equal. Our freedoms are situated. When we're born, where we're born, who we're born to, in what society we're born into, right? Like we have situated freedom. In order for the limitations of our freedom to be surpassed, we need other people. And I say in the book that happens from the moment that we're born. Like we don't just like give birth to ourselves. There are hopefully, if you are fortunate enough, several people, a doula, medical professionals, right? Like you have people actually bringing you into the world, right? Like the person who has been feeding and nurturing you, growing you, right? Inside of them. Nobody lives in a silo. Nobody, to quote another racist dog whistle, lifts them up by their own bootstraps, right? This whole bootstraps argument. So again, the first step is to claim it. The second step is to really, in doing so, take it back from the white supremacist, cis heteropatriarchy. And part of that means, again, talking, language, right? This idea of like being in dialogue, amplifying what freedom is truly, as opposed to the white freedom that dominates our society. And I provide my own definition of freedom at that moment, right? Freedom is a lifelong practice, it never ends, of self-creation based on accountability and care that endeavors to build a more free and just world. So accountability and care are crucial, 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 crucial. Like accountability really is like a form of care, right? And then in tandem with the second step, right, this act of reclaiming is also practicing it. And here's what people can do daily. And this again goes back to the beginning, of our conversation about how much respect I have for Danielle Moody Mills, that, she lives her values, right? So how do you live your life? How do you live if you live by the ideal of freedom and understand that our freedoms are connected and that we live in the world with each other, right? We are accountable to each other in different ways. How can you live your life? How can you build your life? That's individually, right? Like how we wake up, how we treat people, how we decide individually, but also like think about our organizations that we work in. Like, how do we spend our money? Especially, capitalism was a bugbear for me in this book, but it's like it's really important to think about how you spend your money and how that reflects your values. And that could be in terms of like where you buy your food, for whom you buy your food. Do you tip your servers? Do you what do you invest in? You can't sit here and talk about the ills of social media and then, be someone who invests in these social media companies to make a buck, right? So it's being very conscientious about how we make ourselves, the language we use about ourselves and each other, and how we act in the world. And that's the kind of practical element that we can practice individually, but also with each other, right? That's really important.
All right, so the name of the book is Breaking Free: The Lie of Equality and the Feminist Fight for Freedom. Go ahead and plug where people can get the book, how can people reach out to you, all that stuff.
Oh, that's really sweet. I mean, thanks, Eric. Gosh, I like to say you can get this book anywhere that amazing books are sold. I also just have a website that I need to update more than I do, marcibianco.com. I'm sometimes on Twitter, but have refrained from really doing a lot of deep engagement with it. But on LinkedIn also, I've been using that. That's actually how you and I connected, right? That was really
Exactly.
great. So yeah, you can reach out to me. I love please reach out. I love talking through ideas, because it helps me. Again, we live in the world together. My ideas will only advance and enrich and become more, complex and complicated through discussion. And I really appreciate all good faith, exchanges, not someone who only reaches out, as a way to kind of tear you down. I try not to engage with that, but good faith questions, I'm totally down for. I'm really, really down for it.
Well, Marcy Bianco, I am glad you were down for coming on this podcast. I greatly appreciate that. And I wish you much success with the book. It was a great read for me, and I hope that it's a great read for others. So again, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much, Eric. This was great.
All right, guys, and we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. And so now, my final guest, Mr. Jason Berlin. Jason Berlin was a TV writer and producer for 18 years until Trump was elected, and he quit his career to join the resistance full time. The California Democratic Party hired him as a regional organizer for LA County, and he rallied a volunteer army who topped the DCCC national charts, registering 6,000 plus voters across Southern California, and helped flip five swing districts in the 2018 midterms, including all of Orange County. Within weeks, he founded Field Team 6 with a simple mission: register Democrats, save the world. By bringing his proudly partisan voter registration to swing states nationwide, Field Team 6 helped register 785,000 Democratic voters in 2020 and brought that total to 2.5 million in 2022. Currently, Field Team 6 is registering new swing state Democrats in order to take back the House, save the Senate, and keep the White House in 2024. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Jason Berlin. All right, Jason Berlin, how you doing, my man? You doing good?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great, especially after that coffee. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on here. I'm
Well,
really honored.
I understand you got to have that caffeine, man, especially doing the work that you're doing. You got to have that fuel. So what I usually like to do when I start these interviews is that I have a quote that either the guests might have said or written or something related to the topic we're going to discuss. So your quote is, the work that Field Team 6 and similar groups do is essential to increasing participation and strengthening our democracy, but you can't out-organize voter suppression. What does that quote mean to you?
That quote, it has was that from me? No.
No, that wasn't from you. That was somebody talking, singing your praises, actually.
Okay, yes. Right. I believe that quote sounds very similar to something Mark Elias said, but it may not be him. yeah, that brings up a lot. I love the first part. I completely disagree with that final phrase, that you can't out-organize voter suppression, because, in fact, that is exactly what the resistance, become the progressive movement, has been doing every single year since Trump got elected. That's what Stacey Abrams did, that, you know, and I feel like, in fact, you know, we should be doing everything we can to end voter suppression, you know, via the courts, via organizing, legislating. But people can be motivated enough to turn out, to register and turn out in numbers great enough to overcome that voter suppression. That's what they did in the Georgia miracle in January 2021, when Georgia, despite lots of voter suppression, all different ways, was able to turn out enough Democratic voters that they sent two Democratic senators to the Senate, including, you know, Reverend Warnock, who speaks in Thunderbolts, and John Ossoff, you know, a Jewish senator. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. And being here in Atlanta through all that process, that was amazing to see how that worked out. So let me ask you this question. How does one go from being a writer for comedy and reality shows to becoming a political activist registering people to vote all over the country?
Yeah. So, well, in my case, it took Trump being elected. I was always a political junkie before then, but when Trump was elected, it did break my heart and mind. I know I'm not alone in that. Thank God for that. It kind of did that to, I think, over half the country. And I was writing for Sharktacular, the Shark Week preview special at the time. And my boss was a Trump supporter. There was just too much cognitive dissonance. I was wearing shirts, liberal-looking shirts, every day to try to get in fights with him. But that wasn't enough. And so I went in February 2017, after the initial coma of mourning about Trump's victory started to wear off. I went to my first activist group meeting. It was happened to be Swing Left. I almost didn't go. There's going to be lots of people I don't know. But I forced myself that first time, and it was in a packed artist's loft in Chinatown, L.A., and it was the feeling of being in a room full of people who felt as crazy as I did. It felt like the only place I could actually be sane. And I was totally moved by being around people who are taking the precious hours of their lives to try to fix this beautiful democracy that needs fixing. And so I just realized I needed to be in lots more rooms like that. That was the start. So I worked with Swing Left for 2017, worked with all the grassroots groups that I met in 2017. In 2018, as in my new capacity working for the California Democratic Party, we registered over 6,000 Democratic voters by the 2018 midterm elections and helped do our part to flip 5 swing districts in Southern California and take back the House. And that's when my job ended with the party. And that was the proudest work I've ever been a part of. to that point. And also, it was kind of crazy that my job would end then. It seemed like a bad time to break up the band. So that's when I founded Field Team 6 with our explicit mission: register Democrats, save the world, so that we could go national, see what kind of good trouble we could get into in battleground states and districts nationwide, where just a few votes make the difference. And so that there could be an organization where we do partisan voter registration all year, every year, a place where institutional knowledge can accumulate, and we can refine our techniques over time, and we can be transparent about what we're doing and what our results are. And that was the beginning. Since then, after Field Team 6 outreach, 2.3 million Democrats and independents have registered to vote, the vast majority in swing states and districts, swinging countless elections.
Yeah, so I guess you kind of answered part of my second question about what the function of Field Team 6 is. Before I get into the other part, I guess, I can relate to the connectivity. When I ran for the U.S. Senate the first time in Mississippi, I was saying in my speeches that I was a blue dot in a red sea. And my job was to connect all the other blue dots and see if we could pull this thing off. And social media was still kind of in its infancy at that point. And, a lot of people started saying, well, yeah, I'm a blue dot. I'm a blue dot, And, to build momentum. And then 2 years later, when I ran again, you really saw that effort, especially with Obama being on the ticket as well. And even though we did not win, the enthusiasm and the energy, and to actually go to Ole Miss campus and see frat houses with Obama banners and people shaking my hand and all that, it was really, really something. So it does feel good to be in a room or be in an environment where you can connect. So I definitely relate to what you were saying about that meeting with the swing left. So why did you choose the name Field Team 6?
That's a good question. I think about 5% of people understand what our name means. I didn't choose it to be confusing, but that's just how it turned out. It's a reference to SEAL Team 6, who got Bin Laden, because we are the crack voter registration group that goes behind enemy lines in these purple districts and does the impossible by, finding good-hearted people who want to register as Democrats or as progressive independents.
So you kind of feel as though your work is like the Democracy Special Forces.
Absolutely. That's a great phrase. Can I steal
Oh
that?
yeah. Feel free to utilize that everywhere you go. What was your what is what is your biggest challenge registering people to vote?
That is a really good question. I think it is, apathy is the greatest enemy. It's not Republicans, it's people not caring. And fortunately, this new generation is the most engaged, the most liberal generation in history. And there are so many young people who are so smart and informed, and you can understand why. In a lot of ways, their world is on fire. I mean, they are getting engaged because they partially because they need to defend their abortion rights. They need a college that's more affordable. They need health care access. They need there to be less gun violence. They don't like having grown up having to do active shooter drills in their schools. The climate, it's there are all these giant issues that affect them directly. And there's studies that say that after someone votes in two elections in a row, they become a lifelong voter. And I feel like so many people were activated to vote in 2018 and then in 2020, that those two in a row were the start of a movement and has just continued. And the new American majority, which is young people, people of color, and women, has already been winning elections. And that is just growing over time every day, every year, when we add 4 million new eligible young people. I think we're going in a good direction. So to answer your question, apathy is the greatest enemy. That's why when we register people, and it is all about connection. We're talking about connection. Everything, all activism is making connections. It's talking to strangers, and it turns out that's how you change the world. So when we talk to strangers, whether it's in person on a college campus or in a text or a postcard or phone call or email, we connect voter registration with a value. We don't just say, hey, register to vote, because if they're not registered, that's not a value to them yet. We connect it with one of those issues, abortion rights or climate rescue. Is that important to you? You know, then here's how to do something about it. Fight back, register to vote. Here's the link.
So is apathy from I don't care, or is it apathy out of frustration saying I don't think my vote matters?
I think it's the latter. It's thinking my vote doesn't matter. Nothing's going to change. The two parties are the same. Even now, you hear that a lot. Two parties are the same. And we who live and breathe this know how crazy untrue that is, especially right now at this moment in history. And I feel like it's our job to let people know that without judgment, because especially when you're talking to young people, but really any like low, no information person, people are very attuned to whether you're judging them or not, you know? So the first 1,000 times, you know, a young person said something to me like, oh, Obama, well, he was a Republican, right? You know, it did blow my mind the first 1,000 times. And then I got used to it. And I tried to deliver the basic information, you know, that the Democratic Party is the only major party fighting for women's rights, civil rights, workers' rights, LGBTQ+ rights, voting rights, climate rescue, all these things. Try to deliver that without any judgment. I feel like a lot of, you know, young people grew up in a family without politics, who didn't talk about politics. And to them, politics is just this loud room where everyone's yelling at each other. And if you go into that room and you haven't chosen a side, then both sides are yelling at you. So you just stay out of that room. So we're there to show people you can have a calm, pleasant, positive conversation about politics with no yelling or hostility.
Yeah.
Or judgment.
Yeah, and that's very important. The education piece is important. I just remember when I first ran for the legislature, since it was a special election, we had to do it by petition. And I literally had people ask, you know, what does the job do and all that. And one guy actually said, so you're trying to go to Washington? And I said, no, I'm trying to go to the Capitol in Jackson. And he said, the Capitol's here in Jackson? I said, yes, sir. That big building downtown with the gold dome, that's, well, we got a little gold on our dome. Not as much as Georgia, but he said, that's the Capitol building. He was like, man, I had no idea. When I ran for the U.S. Senate, people were asking which half of the state I was going to represent. You know what I'm saying? So the education is very important to understand that you have to educate. And like you said, you can't be judgmental. But I want to say the toughest thing I had to deal with, and I don't know if what your strategy has been with it, was dealing with the suffrage laws, right? So In my case, it was dealing with people who had been formerly incarcerated and getting them to vote. And in Mississippi, we have like 8 constitutional charges that takes away your right to vote. And the Attorney General, who was a Democrat, by the way, when somebody asked him an opinion, he said, well, actually, it's really 22. It's like, look, don't make it worse, man. We're just trying to figure out, you know. But he said, because when he was talking of breaking down into subcategories. But the reality was it's 8. And so in order for you to get your rights back in the state of Mississippi, a legislator would have to introduce a bill with your name on it and what you were convicted of and present it. And it has to go through the whole committee process and all that stuff. And you have to get 2/3 of the legislature to vote for it and all that. So needless to say, it's very few. Now, I was very fortunate in the 9 years that I was there. I got 3 people their rights to vote. Wow. But and there's a long story I can tell you about one particular one, but I won't do that on the air. But, you know, and so and just going up to people and trying to get them registered, they said, well, you know, I've been to jail. Did you go to jail on a drug charge? No. Okay, so I need you to fill this form out, blah, blah. If they were arrested on a drug charge in the state of Mississippi, ironically, they'd never lose their right to vote. They don't know that, but you have to educate them. So I was wondering, I've run into the apathy thing a lot, but had you run into any situations like that dealing with formerly incarcerated folk?
Definitely. So the best place in, well, I think in the country that I've ever registered voters is outside the courthouse in Lancaster, California, which is California's a blue state for the White House, but that's a swing House district north of L.A. Have spoken to lots of returning citizens, who had committed a felony and or have done the time, and no one is in any rush to tell them that they can now re-register to vote in California. They're always surprised when we tell them that, and sometimes there are tears. It means so much to people. It's really moving. In Arizona, tons of people we speak to at in-person voter drives say, I can't vote, I'm a felon. And it's up to us to let them know that in Arizona, and of course these laws vary maddeningly from state to state. No two states are the same. Part of why we need some good federal voting rights legislation, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, that guy right up here in the postcard in my background here. what a giant. So in Arizona, so many people we talk to say they can't vote. So we tell them, if you've just been convicted of one felony, then you can absolutely re-register as soon as you are out of jail or prison. You can re-register immediately. No one tells them that. If it's two or more, then it's a hassle. They make it a real hassle, and you have to petition to get your rights back. And you can, but it's a lot of effort and more than most people will go to. And it's they make it so easy there to get a felony that strips you of your voting rights. It's just another form of voter suppression that we're fighting against.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, because when in Mississippi, the history, you know, that constitution was written in 1890. That was the first constitution after Reconstruction. And so basically they tried to pick 8 felonies that they thought black people did to make sure that, because one of the charges is bigamy. If you marry more than one wife, you lose your right to vote in the state of Mississippi. Not that we're encouraging bigamy or why they think black folks back then were doing that, but that was one of the felonies you could lose your voting rights to.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, do you do any kind of tracking of those you registered to see if they actually come to the polls? And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, a lot of times people do voter registration drives and, you know, they're getting the numbers up. And one thing that was noticed here in Georgia was that Georgia, percentage wise, had the best voter registration rate in the nation. It was like in the 90s, but the turnout wasn't happening. And so you had mentioned Stacey Abrams, and one of the things that she did was not only to make sure that they registered people to vote, but it was like, you know, they were sending text messages. And because I had moved into the state, you know, in 2017, so I fell into that new voter category. So, you know, anytime there was an election, it was like, hey, you know, even if they didn't register you personally, their organization, they kept track of new voter registrations. And they were like saying, hey, did you, you know, have you early voted yet? And, you know, do you need an absentee ballot? I mean, they were constantly doing it. And I think that was part of her success, at least the first time running, you know, in order to, and with Warnock and also, huh?
So you mean the time that she won and it was stolen from her?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That yeah. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, it was like, it was an effective way to, make sure that people were able to track what was going on. So does your organization do tracking, or do you just basically get the numbers and then hope that, like, other, you know, other campaigns or whatever do the tracking?
So the answer is yes, absolutely. We do not only register new voters, but track whether they vote. And so to answer this fully, I want to tell you about the database that Field Team 6 has built, which is unique in the country. It is a database made of not registered voters, but unregistered voters who are likely Democrats. So when COVID hit, we had to pull all our in-person voter drives off the calendar and go digital. And that's when we learned how to build this database. We work with political data vendors, and we have filled the database with millions of, like I said, unregistered people. They're deemed likely Democrats using a combination of age, gender, and location, and some purchase data. So, you know, for example, if they drive a Prius like I do, there's increased chance they're going to be a Democrat. So we use that database as the basis for all our digital outreach. That is, you know, via postcard, text, email, phone call. It's all through that database, which means that after we register people, we can check that database against the updated voter rolls after an election and see who registered and see who of them voted. So, for example, just give you an example. In the 2022 cycle, we reached out to 5 million unregistered likely Democrats in our database. Out of those 5 million, 1.57 million registered. Comes to about 1 in 3 that we contacted wound up registering to vote. And out of those, 660,000 of them, 250,000, voted in the 22 midterms. Wow. So that's, yeah, that's 250,000 votes that we're responsible for. And so those votes came to more than the margin of victory for Democratic Governor Tony Evers in Wisconsin, for Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs in Arizona, who just won by a hair over insane person Carrie Lake. And it came to more than the margin of victory for Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada, who secured Democratic control of the Senate. Yeah. So, yes, really making a difference.
Yeah, and that's impressive. So how crucial is it to get people registered to vote in 2024?
Yes, thank you for asking me that. So here's why. Voter registration, partisan voter registration, the way we do it, is the number one most effective thing we can do to win elections. That is a bold statement, and I can back that up. So we all know young people turn out about 23% normally. What most people don't know is that young people who were registered to vote in 2020 came out at 86%.
Hmm.
That It is mind blowing, right? So the act of registration turns them into super voters. And it's not just young people. In the general population, among registered voters, 85% on average vote in a presidential election. So that means our model needs to change. Right now, everyone is focused on getting out the vote. The Democratic Party, at all levels, from national to local, every single Democratic campaign, almost all grassroots groups are focused on purely on getting registered voters out to vote. That's great, but that's just the last half. It's like no one has had a talk, the talk with the party about where a Democrat comes from, you know, like, so the first half of the equation is registering new Democrats. And when it comes to partisan registration in swing states, Field Team 6 is the one and only national organization doing that. So we're like the voice in the wilderness, like yelling, hey, bring a tiny, tiny bit of all those resources over here, volunteers, donations, bring them to the voter registration side, and we will win more elections.
Since you went down that road, go ahead and make a plug how people can get in touch with you and how people can make those donations to Field Team 6.
Thank you. Yes, if you go to fieldteam6.org, that's, you know, the word field, word team, number 6.org, there is a donate button in the upper right. We have brought the cost down to a dollar. It's actually a little less, but a dollar for every blue and purple voter that we register. That is the best bargain in activism. It's the best value proposition there is. We do this super effectively. We have only 3 paid people on staff, including myself. We have over 100 people on our volunteer staff. Immensely qualified, dedicated people, almost all women, by the way, giving hours and hours every week to lead 20 different specialized teams. We have almost 20,000 volunteers across the country in every state, and that is why we're able to do this so cost effectively. It blows away every other organization I know. We're super proud of that. So yes, anything you give helps. You can also volunteer on the website right under the actions menu. It says volunteer ops. Plenty of ways every single day of the week. You can help us postcard or text, make some calls, do some in-person voter drives, or social media storm. All of it helps.
Well, Jason, I'm a partisan person. Even though my show, allow people with other opinions to come on, it's pretty well known that I'm a Democrat. So I'm going to say this, you're doing God's work, and I greatly appreciate what you're doing. And not just from a partisan sense, but from a holistic sense of building our democracy and building credibility back in our democracy by getting people engaged. I think the only way we're going to continue to improve is that the citizens get engaged. I want you to vote for Democrats. You want people to vote for Democrats, but we want people to be engaged, period. And so I greatly appreciate the fact that you have ventured off from your chosen profession to do this calling. And I am really honored that you took the time out to be on this podcast.
I'm honored to be here, and I'm very grateful to you for everything you do and have done, from running for office, one of the bravest things a human can do, to running this podcast. You know, we are only as effective as people are aware of us, you know, and so spreading awareness of good causes like ours, it's crucial. Thank you so much.
All right, Jason. All right, guys, and we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So I just want to thank my guests for coming on. An incredibly powerful show. And I hope that again, that my guests are inspiring to you or informative to you. And just look forward to having another season. Like I said, this is season number 9. And looking forward to doing more and more as the months and the years go forward. All right, guys, until next time.